The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Dodd, page 23 of his book on parables, says this, somewhat overstated, I think, but here he goes. While the allegory is merely a decorative illustration of teaching supposed to be accepted on other grounds, well, I doubt whether premier allegorists would accept that without fighting. While the allegory is merely a decorative illustration of teaching supposed to be accepted on other grounds, the parable has the character of an argument. And I would comment, only some do. But I think, nevertheless, is it worth pondering, all right? Because I think there's a grain of truth in this, or I wouldn't have been quoting it in the first place, all right? The parable has the character of an argument in that it entices the hearer to a judgment upon the situation depicted and then challenges him directly or by implication to apply that judgment to the matter at hand. For instance, Nathan's parable to David, Old Testament. This is 2 Samuel 12. That is not, by any stretch of the imagination, merely a decorative illustration of teaching supposed to be accepted on other grounds. Although Nathan has to assume that David has a sense of justice, right? You know, and the parable goes on. I hope you're familiar with it. He sets up an illustration that appeals to David's sense of justice. And David makes a pronouncement of this man deserves to die because he's shown no mercy and so on. So it entices the hearer to a judgment upon the situation depicted. That's exactly what happened to David. And then challenges him directly or by implication to apply that judgment to the matter at hand. And that's where Nathan's parable is so beautiful, because he says, you are the man, right? And in case David still doesn't understand, even then tells David how it applies to him. But my observation concerning that is that in Nathan's parable, the effectiveness of the parable depends, I think, quite a bit on there being a considerable amount of detail of correspondence between the invented story of the lamb and the poor man and the rich man and so on, and David's actual situation. In other words, it only works if, in fact, it's an allegory. So the fact is, you see, that it refutes Dodd's idea that an allegory is merely a decorative illustration. And in fact, it almost turns it on its head in saying to be persuasive in the way that Dodd is indicating, often a parable has to have quite a bit of detail, striking amount of correspondence in order to overcome the resistance of the person who otherwise is going to say, no, that's not really relevant, that's not me, right? What about the parable of the lost sheep, for instance? I mean, we can't spend a lot of time going into this, and partly, you know, if you do work on a parable, look for this kind of thing, right? Whether there isn't some element of conviction, right? The parable of the lost sheep in Luke 15 is told in the context of the Pharisees and the scribes who were murmuring because Jesus received sinners and ate with them. And it enables him to ask probingly whether that isn't appropriate even on their terms, basically, you see, if they're the righteous people, but here are people in need. So it becomes something of a persuasive speech that is intended to ask the scribes and the Pharisees to rethink their critical views of Jesus' ministry. Okay, so I think there is something to be said for Dodd's observation that there is some at least some parables have the character of an argument, as he says. Okay, then, this is point 7. Dodd's definition of a parable is this. The parable is a metaphor or simile drawn from nature or common life, arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness. Let me pause. You've got the, that's page 16 of Dodd, but you've also, I've printed it out there for you, so you don't have to take it down. But let me inject some comments here. Metaphor or simile is already two levels of meaning, right? But I've broadened it out. It can be an exemplary story, right? So I think this is a little too narrow, but still, it's on the right track. Metaphor or simile drawn from nature or, I say, from nature of common life. That's a misprint. Nature or common life. Nature, that is, growing seeds. Common life, shepherds, and people who give feasts. That's what he's thinking of. Arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness. Now, that's worth thinking about, too. Although any good storyteller, to a certain extent, does things, right? But there's particular concern in Jesus' case to have people pay attention because of the weighty religious significance of what he has to teach. And there's something here, I think, that is related to the idea of the mashal. Because a proverb, you see, think of the stuff in the book of the Proverbs, is often pithy. It's vivid or it's strange. You have to think about it a little bit sometimes, right? And that's productive. It's not, and I'm thinking, you know, these dynamics equivalence theory of translation often said, the point is to make everything clear. No, it isn't. Because you can achieve things sometimes precisely if everything is not transparent and on the surface. You get people thinking. All right. And leaving the mind in sufficient doubt about it worth paying attention to, asking yourself whether the point, whether the crafting of a parable isn't sometimes not to make everything transparent immediately, to tease it into active thought. Interesting. But I would say this, too, that the generation of two levels of meaning, shepherds and sheep on the one hand and God and sinners on the other hand, for instance, the existence of two levels of meaning automatically creates a possibility, at least theoretically, of misreading the second and vital level, right? Because you start out with a story of shepherds and sheep, but clearly that's not the main thing, you see. There is a second level. Well, what is it? Because there's two levels, rather than a direct statement, now God is concerned to go after and find, you know, you could do it literally, right? But because it's not said, first of all, literally, there is automatically, at least theoretically, the possibility of misreading the second level. Although I believe some parables, at least, are easy, quote unquote. For instance, the parable of the wicked tenants in Luke 20, 9-19. If you turn over to that. Now, I don't mean to say every aspect and every implication of the parable is easy, but on the level of saying, what does this stand for, right? Of the sort of elementary level, Luke 20, verse 9. Now, I won't read the whole thing, but this is the He went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard, but the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. You probably remember the rest of this story. He sends others, finally he sends his son. Verse 19, look at it. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. They were not dummies. And they didn't even need to be terribly smart to figure it out. This is fairly transparent, right, to the degree that even his enemies can see what he's getting at, although they don't believe it, right? You know, they aren't persuaded, in a positive sense, to desist from their attempts. So you could say, in a sense, that they understand it, in a sense, they don't understand it, right? But on the level of a basic decoding of the thing and saying that the owner stands for God and the tenants stand for Israel, or perhaps particularly the leaders of Israel, and the, you know, the people who are sent are prophets, and finally Christ himself. That's fairly straightforward. But some parables also are hard, or at least harder. The parable of the sower, Luke 8, 4-8, the disciples have to ask him. Now, that parable comes with an interpretation. But not everybody, if you look at it carefully, not everybody heard the interpretation. The disciples went and asked Jesus. So if you take the parable without its subsequent interpretation, then it is, at least comparatively, harder, because even the disciples weren't quite sure what was the point. I think at this point in the course, at least, I'm encouraging you to have an open mind, but also not to assume that they all have to be the same degree of easiness or difficulty. Right? Why should we assume that? And it certainly looks, I mean, I'm looking at these things at an elementary point of view at this point and saying, doesn't it look to you as if at one point, this one parable, that people got the point? Now, even there might be some difficulty, you know, if we didn't have this first century background, because the allusion to the vineyard is based on something in the Old Testament, Isaiah 5, most directly. So you're saying, well, we do sometimes need that, or we might be puzzled at how the, although we have the text, you know, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way, because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. With that much help, even if we didn't have some of this background, then we could sort of figure it out. So that's nice, but I think the observation that sometimes it's useful to have the background is nice. And remember the parable of mustard seed, where lo and behold, this thing that looks rather simple on the surface and this thing about the birds of the air making nests in the branches may not be so simple. Maybe that is this illusion. So there are things like that. So I would agree with the people who are saying, well, let's make some explorations of the environment. But I don't want us to get committed in a sort of a priori fashion to assuming that all the parables are going to be equally easy or equally difficult. And it doesn't look that way to me either. But I think I'm not through with that either, Matt, and you probably can guess that. We will inevitably come back and you know, keep working at that issue, because it is an important issue. And I think you're right to have brought it up, of saying, even in terms of modern interpretation, we have a whole spectrum of how people think it's appropriate to react. Okay. Well, with that much said, where are we in our outline? So there's Dodd's definition, which I'm not throwing out as a good definition in every respect, but as a statement arresting the hearer by its vividness or strangeness, and at least provoking us to think, right? If I may paraphrase somewhat what he says about parables, going to use his own definition as something to at least to keep in mind as one possibility of things that parables may do. Capital C, then, the parable of the sower. Now we're going to look at a particular parable, and I hope eventually you will see why this particular parable is of particular importance. And so we're going to spend some time on it. The parable of the sower, which occurs, as you may be aware, in three places, in Matthew, in Mark, and in Luke. And we will look mostly at the Lucan version, not for any particular reason except that I used to teach more on Luke than on Matthew and Mark. So I feel, you know, a little more at home, but really all three versions, of course, will be relevant. Okay, so point one is Dodd's challenge concerning parables in general, but of the sower in particular. He says, yet it must be confessed that the Gospels themselves give encouragement to this allegorical method of interpretation. Now, Dodd is a representative of the single point theory that I've described, all right? That, no, I haven't described it very well, but Boucher certainly interacts with it. But the idea is basically that Jesus spoke parables, not allegories, right? They're using that false distinction, and that he had then one point for each of them. And this began with Ulliker. Primarily, as I said, Ulliker thought that the point was a moral one. And people like Dodd disagree with what Ulliker makes out of the parables, but they don't disagree that there's one point. And then after he said this, he says, it must be confessed that the Gospels themselves give encouragement to this allegorical method of interpretation. Mark interprets the parable of the sower Mark 4:13-20, and likewise I would indicate Luke 8:11-15, and Matthew, the parable of the tares and the one of the dragnet, Matthew 13:36-43 and 13:49-50, on just such principles, and both attribute their interpretations to Jesus himself. That's page 13. And that's a quote from Dodd. And then point two is that behind this is the judgment on Dodd's part and on the part of many of the historical critical tradition that the interpretation of some of these parables is inauthentic. That is, that it's something that comes from the early church and not from Jesus himself, and that the church got off on the wrong foot by interpreting the things allegorically. Although Boucher, you could see, is already refuting that. She is not herself, as far as I can see, an evangelical. She's in the critical tradition, but she's saying to other critics, let's be honest about what we're doing and admit that all the parables are about the same in this way. Because before her, most people had said, oh, here's the parable of the sower. It's interpreted allegorically. We know that's wrong. So that's a secondary thing. That's the early church. You can see it, you know, it was used polemically, not only against this sort of hyper detail of some of church tradition in their interpretation, but it was used against the Gospels themselves to claim that the interpretations were secondary, were not from Jesus, even though they claimed to be from Jesus. They were later inventions of the church, and went the direction of what the scholars called allegory, a many-point thing, but they falsified the meaning of Jesus. So then, you see, that gave them lots of space to try to recover the authentic meaning of the, you know, you can go on and on about this, but it becomes a little bit absurd in the light of Boucher's criticisms, because the whole thing was really built on the sands of an unclear distinction. Nevertheless, even if we don't accept that distinction, the question remains from the critics whether the interpretations that are given to us in the Gospels are secondary, that is, they're additions by the early church. And Dodd objects in particular that in the interpretation, the seed is the Word of God, but the crop is classes of people, and that this really does not mesh. So he says the interpretation really does not work. But I would observe, and that's a sign of its inauthenticity. And once having established that one interpretation is inauthentic, you know, then it's a domino, it's much easier to claim that others are as well. But my response to that would be that the breaking away from a one-to-one correspondence, a very neat and as it were, mathematical or mechanical correspondence between the two levels, indicates an allegory which is somewhat looser, you might say, but not that it's therefore inauthentic. And the whole argument of inauthenticity, I think, is mostly based on this bogus distinction between parable and allegory that we've already seen being shot down by Boucher. But even though Dodd's objections are no good, what do we say to the general thing? Well, I do not think you can prove to a critic that these things are authentic, that is, that they go back to Jesus. How would you? Because he's skeptical to begin with, you know, and just so I end up saying, well, they're in the Gospels and they're attributed to Jesus, why not? Right? Especially because I believe in the inspiration of the Gospels. But even if you believe that these people were trying to give you what Jesus did, you know, even if you didn't believe that they were the inspired Word of God, but just that they were records from honest human beings, why shouldn't we? And I think almost all the resistance has come by people who have their own agenda, when you think about it. Now, yeah, there are people who are saying, well, the interpretation contains words that are not otherwise there, you know, on the lips of Jesus in other passages. Well, of course they contain words like that, because the interpretation brings in things that he doesn't elsewhere talk about. I mean, that, you know, you can produce these arguments because the vocabulary is unusual. Well, it's unusual because he never has occasion elsewhere to talk about exactly these issues again, you know. So I think the arguments that are often used are flimsy. Of course, an author can say something different. And he can say something a little different in the interpretation than he said in the story that he gave. So I can't prove it to somebody, you know, who doesn't trust the gospel writers, but neither can they make any kind of reasonable case against it. So, you know, it's a standoff, I think, even within the framework of worldly arguments, within the framework of Christian arguments. I think we have solid reason for trusting the gospel's reports and believing that the interpretations, the longer interpretations then, are authentic.